From Washington, D.C., a city still rubbing its eyes in complete and utter disbelief, two superb journalists on the shock of Donald Trump, Matthew Continetti and Andrew Ferguson on Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A graduate of Columbia University, Matthew Continetti is editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon. A graduate of Occidental College, who also studied theology at Berkeley, Andrew Ferguson is the author of a number of books, including Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College, and he is a senior editor of the Weekly Standard. Andy, Matt, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
On election night, David Remnick, the editor-in-chief of The New Yorker, quote, this is on The New Yorker's website, hours after Donald Trump becomes the winner, quote, "The election of Donald Trump to the presidency is nothing less than a tragedy for the American Republic, a tragedy for the Constitution, and a triumph for the forces at home and abroad of nativism, authoritarianism, misogyny, and racism. It is impossible to react to this moment with anything less than revulsion and profound anxiety." Close quote.
He was drunk. It was 4 a.m. He'd been sitting there watching TV all night.
And he clearly wasn't in the Free Beacon's offices when the race was
Although everybody there was drunk, too.
Okay, so that's just so over the top, we put it aside. Yes?
Well, I think we shouldn't put it aside because it represents the opinion of most of the media, most of Hollywood, most of New York, most of the religious establishment, most of the elite.
And how much of this town?
Quite almost 80, 85%, I'd say, of Washington, D.C.
Okay. And why the shock? Why? Look, I was watching the polls as much as anybody else, and it looked as though Hillary Clinton was going to win. But at his worst moments after the convention, at his worst moments when he was attacking that poor Muslim soldier who died fighting for this country, his support was still around 40%. Over a third, two-fifths of Americans supported him even in his worst moments. Why didn't anybody see this coming, Andrew?
Well, there are a few people who did. Sean Trendy at
Real Clear Politics.
Real Clear Politics, who's one of the best analysts of political trends there is, hence the name, I guess. He saw it, and a few people who were just dismissed as cranks saw it. I thought they were cranks. I mean, it just seemed inconceivable to me. And I think what I did that I should, what I didn't do that I should have done, it was to underestimate how badly people felt about Hillary Clinton. And I still think that, putting a positive spin on what Trump represents and all that stuff, it really was a strong anti-Hillary vote. It just sort of, they'd seen enough of this woman for the last 25 years. They couldn't stand her hectoring from the podium for another 4 years. And there was a strong motivation for a lot of people.
And a strong anti-Obama vote as well. To what extent is this a repudiation of the Obama agenda?
I think it's an incredible repudiation of Obama, but not necessarily in the way the media thinks it is. I actually think Trump positively won the election. There was clearly a negative judgment on Hillary, but there was also a negative judgment on Trump. And Americans knew who they were voting for. And the reason I think that he won in the end was that he won the economic issue. Hillary Clinton, if you go back in her campaign, Hillary's campaign was very well conceived in order to hold the Obama coalition that put him in the White House twice. And it was based on the theory that it was liberal social issues that drove Obama's victory, and playing identity politics by getting the right number of African American voters, the right number of Hispanic voters, the right number of LGBTQ voters, the right number of women voters, you will be able to assemble a permanent Democratic bloc. There was one thing missing: issues. And despite her reputation as this policy wonk, if you go back and you look at Hillary Clinton's speeches, she barely raised economic issues. She was in a problem. There was a reason she didn't want to raise them. It was because she had to somehow find a way to separate herself from the incumbent, be the agent of change. She decided, I'm not going to do that. All I'm going to do is run a negative campaign on Donald Trump in order to get out my favorite constituencies. Meanwhile, Trump was going to his states, and he was hammering the economic issue, not in a way that made Republicans feel comfortable, but in a way that definitely brought out enough voters to swing those states that Republicans haven't won in decades.
Okay. Andy Ferguson in the Weekly Standard, quote, one of the weirder aspects of the anti-Trump mania is its sniffy tone. Explain that, Andrew.
Well, you know, it's well documented the disdain that the elites, as we say, feel for Trump, both as a candidate and now as a president-elect. But what struck me as odd is it's clearly a class-based contempt. And but a lot of the same people who have this class-based contempt of Trump are also the people who have really been responsible for the kind of cultural vulgarity that's started to infuse the country, you know, two generations ago. You know, Hollywood people, TV people, the news media, you know, we're to the point where Beyonce can talk about Monica Lewinsky-ing all over her dress, and then she gets invited to the White House and is feted as, you know, America's chanteuse. There's countless examples of just vulgarity and a dumbing down, I think, is the word that some people have used. And they refuse to take responsibility for it, especially when Donald Trump is also taking advantage of that. He's vulgar. He's materialistic. He uses bad language in public. He's been married many times. He's famous as a sexual libertine, and so on and so on and so on. He actually fits very nicely into the culture that the elites have created.
So your point is that the universities, the mainstream media, Hollywood, all these culture-making institutions have been in the hands of the liberals and the left for half a century, and they have created a culture in which Donald Trump could flourish.
Yeah, and I think nobody wants to say that. Certainly the elites don't want to take any credit for him. And the people who are really...
And I'd like to point out, it's not my thought, it's yours.
Yes, and I think, of course, the people who love Trump see him as sort of an eruption of, you know, the true American character, championing the little guy and economic populism and all that kind of stuff. My view of Trump has been mostly aesthetic, and that's my objection to him is mostly aesthetic. And but looked at aesthetically as a cultural figure, he fits in perfectly with the culture that liberal Democrats have created over the last 40 or 50 years.
Mm. How we got here. Matt, in a recent article in the Washington Free Beacon, you described the 1978 debate over the Panama Canal Treaty between Ronald Reagan and William F. Buckley Jr. Buckley was in favor of the treaty, which did, of course, pass in 79, as I recall, and Ronald Reagan was against it. And you write, a replay of the controversy over the Panama Canal Treaty is exactly what the American right has been experiencing over the last 16 months. Explain that.
Well, what the American right has been experiencing is the perennial conflict between its intellectual wing, which is very small, and its populist wing, which is very large. And as you study the history of American conservatism, you see from the very beginning a really debate about how acclimated to the establishment should the conservative movement be. And so figures like Buckley and one of his mentors, James Burnham, were always more open to the idea of creating kind of a conservative counter-elite that could take over the government, as opposed to people like, say, the activist Richard Viguerie, the founders of the Heritage Foundation, the creators of things like NCPAC, Phyllis Schlafly, Patrick Buchanan, were always very much for a grassroots populist right that rather than move into the quarters of power would knock them over. And so you saw that in the debate over the Panama Canal. You saw that in the perennial debate over the Goldwater and Rockefeller wings of the Republican Party. You saw it about the place of Patrick Buchanan in the Republican Party in the 90s. We took a whole decade to figure out whether Pat was part of the party or not. And that emerged once again in a way none of us really expected with the rise of Donald Trump. And of course, the decision that the voters made was to reject the conservative intellectuals in favor of the grassroots populism that Trump now champions.
You write, Matt, Trump's antagonism toward the Eastern establishment is obvious. And I guess it is obvious, but isn't it also puzzling? Donald Trump, born rich in a nice neighborhood in Queens, makes money all his life moving into an even nicer neighborhood in Manhattan and now living in the penthouse of a building he himself built. And he went to the University of Pennsylvania, which is, after all, an Ivy League institution.
The best.
The best.
The best school.
The best school, to hear him tell it.
He has the best words. That's why they let him in.
Yeah.
And so the question, why is this man antagonistic toward the establishment of which he is in so many ways a representative?
I would say it's not that unique. I mean, obviously, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was called a traitor to his class for being a blue blood member of the New York aristocracy, and yet leading in some ways a populist, not quite as populist as some of the other currents going on in the Depression, but very much the champion of the forgotten man. And if you look at the rhetoric coming out of Trump Tower, especially in the weeks since his election, it's all about the forgotten man. So you find populist movements are often led by elites who are they using it cynically, this populist fervor? Are they in genuine accordance with its goals? It's sometimes it can be hard to say.
You make an interesting point. Up until the election of Donald Trump, didn't it used to be an unwritten rule of American politics that a rich, polished, urbane candidate could only get away with it if he ran from the left? The Roosevelts, an ancient American family, Franklin Roosevelt, born to great wealth, and he gets away with it because he runs against his own class, the Kennedys. The Kennedys were not as liberal as Kennedys are these days, but John Kennedy still, he's running for the common man. And Donald Trump, wealthy figure, stands up and says, I don't pay taxes, I'm rich. I figure out how to use the tax. It's the most amazing thing. He's running to the right as a rich establishment figure.
But that's because the establishment is now on the left. I mean, when Roosevelt was running and you wanted to be anti-establishment, i.e. populist, you had to run to the left. I don't really quite see Trump as part of the Eastern elite, you know, even with the University of Pennsylvania. I know people have tried to turn him into that, but if you look through his life, he's always been slightly, you know, low class. I mean, people didn't, he was tabloid fodder. He was the kind of guy who would actually do a reality TV show. Now, people like, say, David Remnick or Graydon Carter or Barry Diller or any of the sort of heads of the elite classes, that's just so vulgar. And so it's not quite like Roosevelt coming out of...
No, you know. So let me push that a little bit further. So given the place where he started and given the education that he had, Donald Trump could have assimilated into the haute elite of Manhattan with the greatest of ease. He had the education, he had the money. If only he wouldn't wear those bright red ties. If only he'd have his suits better tailored. If only he... Do you see what I mean?
If only he'd had a brain transplant.
He had entree of all kinds.
He relishes this.
He chooses it.
A sense of being on the outside. Now, I should say also, it's a particular kind of vulgarity that the elites disdain. I mean, they're quite happy with, you know, I mentioned Beyonce, or quite happy with all kinds of vulgarity. But it's this kind of low-rent vulgarity that they can't stand.
Well, remember one of the words that Trump supporters often used when they were explaining why they were for him, even in the Republican primaries, it was because he was politically incorrect.
Right.
Which is another way of saying you're ill-mannered, which is something I think Donald Trump has always been. One of the most revealing quotes that Trump himself has said came in a 15-bit biography that came out about him, where he told the biographer, and was quite frank, he said, basically, I'm like a six-year-old boy. And it's very true. Trump can be impulsive. He can change his mind. He can be rude. But he's also very frank. And he can posture. And that is basically what you encounter in a playground. And so despite his wealth, And despite what you would imagine to be his prominence in New York society, he doesn't have the manners. He is not politically correct. And I think for that reason, he's always been, as Andy says, kind of on the margins.
Right, right. So Trump and conservatives, once again, I'm quoting you, Matt, the triumph of populism has left conservatism marooned, confused, uncertain, depressed, anxious, and searching for viability, close quote. Andrew, cheer him up.
Can't do it, Peter.
You Sorry. Can't?
No, well, you know.
Hold on, I'll give it a try. Okay. I'll give it a try. Fellas, this man hasn't even taken office yet. The markets have set new highs. The Europeans are talking seriously for the first time in decades about actually chipping into NATO, what NATO requires them to chip in. Republicans on the Hill are unified, and the forces of political correctness, those commanding heights of the culture, the universities, the mainstream media, are everywhere confused and off balance and on the defensive. And there's an argument to be made that even though he has yet to take office, Donald Trump has accomplished more for conservatives than any president since Ronald Reagan. Yes, Matthew?
I don't know if I go that far, but I do.
Well, just
I do
a little
think,
bit of
no, no. Well,
I'm just
I
trying
will
to
say
cheer
this.
You up.
I've always thought that Trump had the potential to be actually a great president.
Oh, do
that
tell.
Doesn't mean he'd be great for the conservative intellectual movement. And so there, all the things that you in your catalog, Peter, I agree with, and it's going to either end very badly or very well for Trump and for the Republicans and for the country. But when you think about the self-conception of conservative intellectuals who thought that basically the movement started by Buckley and Chambers and Burnham 60 years ago was this flourishing intellectual tendency that had real purchase among the country at large, what I think the campaign revealed is that's not true. And that, in fact, even the ideas have grown stale. And so when I talk about conservatism, where it's left in this election, I'm meaning kind of the people who work at think tanks, the people who work at journals, and the people who kind of fancy themselves conservative intellectuals. I think they're the ones who are kind of looking back now and saying, what happened?
Yeah, but you know, we are such a tiny, tiny part of even the Washington establishment. Right. It's true that we were all under the delusion that people had been reading James Burnham the way we had, or you know, had made Buckley as much of an icon as many of us had. If Trump succeeds, what Buckley wanted to do was the march through the institutions,
right,
as the left had done. It's almost like aping the left. The institution that he was able to take over, maybe the only one, or people like him, was the Republican Party. And so you have now something that Trump can take advantage of, and I think we're seeing in these early appointments, is taking advantage of. There's a great bench strength. There's a lot of diversity, even the kind of diversity that they love on college campuses, and ethnic and racial diversity. There's a tremendous amount of competence that he can draw on. And if he is going to be a successful president or a great president, it's going to be because the conservative intellectuals took over the Republican Party and turned it into something quite substantial and productive.
Got it. So, all right.
That cheers me up.
Yeah, well, actually, Andy and I talked about I'm revealing this. This is really a therapy session for you. Well,
usually I don't go to Andy when I want to be cheered
no,
up.
That, no. Listen, kind of a lightning round through the issues here. I'm just going to name a few issues. And the question is really pretty simple. Is Trump going to stick with what he said he was going to do, or was that a negotiating position? So, well, the economy. He's called for tax cuts and regulatory reform, pro-growth. He's also called for a $1 trillion infrastructure program and for all kinds of protection. Who shows up on January 20th? The tax-cutting pro-growth president or the big government protectionist?
Both. And that's why it's still hard to understand Donald Trump. Both will show up. And you ask whether he means it or whether it's a negotiating position. It's all a negotiating position. Nothing is settled until he decides it. So it's kind of fun to be in the parlor game in Washington, D.C. that we've been experiencing since his election, where we'd say, oh, look at all the people going in and out of Trump Tower. Who's he going to pick? He had dinner with Mitt Romney. Nothing matters until he finally pulls the trigger and names these people to office. And it's the same way with these policies. Nothing will matter until the policy is actually signed into law at his desk. And then, of course, it will become the best policy ever.
But so that goes back to Andy's point. If both Trumps show up, then it becomes extremely important, the concrete realities on the Hill, what committee hearings are going to be. And that is why it's a kind of miracle. He just named Tom Price, congressman from Georgia, to be the HHS secretary. Tom Price is a physician himself, and he spent the last 6 years doing what? Figuring out detail by detail by detail how legislation can be enacted that really will repeal and replace Obamacare. Trump comes along huffing and puffing, and this guy actually knows how to do it. Grab him. That's important.
In a sense, I think the premise of your question is wrong in that there really are two Trumps, that there are two Trumps rhetorically. He's clearly a guy who will say damn near anything, anytime. But free trade is a perfect example. The power of talking and scaring people really is enough to change the lay of the land.
By itself.
Just by itself. You know, the famous story about, I believe it was Schultz, no, it wasn't George Schultz, but someone else in the Reagan White House, and said, you know, Mr. President, if we go out and say that, they'll think we're crazy. The Russians, and he said, well, just tell them you think you're working for a crazy son of a bitch.
Right.
And
Paul Nitzer.
Yeah. So I think that Trump has that kind of advantage. I mean, everybody is off balance. The Republican establishment is off balance. As you say, the Democrats are scattered all over the place. All he really has to do is kind of beat his chest, and a lot of things will get done, even though he's not precisely doing them. I think fantastic news in the paper today is that Carrier, the
air conditioning company
from Indiana, is actually going to announce they're going to keep a bunch of jobs here. That didn't require
no legislation.
It required them wanting to get on the good side of the president, who talks tough.
Foreign policy. If you were the prime minister of Israel, do you feel better now?
Yes, I think they do feel better.
You'd agree with that?
Israel? Yes, absolutely.
If you were the prime minister of Estonia, would you feel better now?
No.
No. I wouldn't.
It's a question.
I'd be
in asking the question, it has the answer.
Yeah. I'd be worried.
Okay. Supreme Court, will he stick to the list of 21? He put together two lists, one of 10, one of 11. According to all the constitutionalists I talk to, every single name on that list is a very reputable name and truly would fulfill the commitment to appoint someone in the mold of Antonin Scalia. Will he do it?
For this appointment, he'll stick to the list. The problem becomes an appointments 2 and 3, and what the lay of the land is when those seats open up on the Supreme Court. But for this one, Trump made many promises. I spent a recent day going through his major speeches over the course of the campaign, and what struck me was how substantive they were. And I'm not kidding. There were something like 30 different policies outlined in the course of this campaign. Did we hear any of them?
No.
Because it was all, again, this is Trump, it was all focused on everything else that he does. But the people at those rallies heard them. Mm. And so I think just, look, the first duty of any politician is to get reelected. And how do you get reelected? Well, the first thing you have to do is to fulfill as many of your campaign pledges as you can. So on the Supreme Court, yes, he'll pick someone of the 21.
Okay. And the abortion. The guy, one of the places, as best I can tell, there wasn't any nuance, no wiggle, no backing off, no, well, maybe I'll think about it again later, which on trade, his position is 20 different places. On tax reform, it's 20 different places. And even though earlier in his life he was pro-choice at various points, throughout this campaign, he has been immovably pro-life. What's he doing? Does he get credit for that?
Well, I think it is still, the old axiom is still true. It is a pro-life party. You can't be nominated in the Republican Party for president without being pro-life. I mean, I'm very happy about that, but I think it's just a fact. You know, it's interesting, though, and I think quite telling, if you compare his view of abortion, mm-hmm. in which he says, look, we want to overturn Roe v. Wade and make it a matter for the states to decide. And then they ask about gay marriage, which was decided in a decision actually quite a bit like Roe v. Wade right. in its outlines and its taking on power right. from the federal government. He says, you know, this is settled law. We're not, the Supreme Court said, I'm not going to do anything about that. So he's clearly got a sensitivity to lots of different constituencies. And he's decided, I guess, that that's just not a fight worth picking.
All right, Donald Trump and Richard Nixon. Andrew, in an article entitled What Trump Can Learn from Nixon, you wrote, no matter who ends up manning the White House staff, it will matter less than we think. How can that be? This entire town is obsessed with who's going to get what job in this coming administration. How can this all matter less than we think?
Well, because it's actually very hard to get things done, partly through the government. Partly it's by design, because you have power decentralized throughout the government, or you're supposed to. Part of it is through the incompetence of the bureaucracy. Part of it is people trying to cover their rear ends. And the example that I cite, you can take up any White House Washington memoir and find other examples of Richard Nixon trying to get some ugly old buildings that were on the National Mall removed. And he said within the first 6 months of his presidency, I want to get those out of there.
Temporary naval offices constructed in 1918.
Temporarily.
And even half century before Nixon took office. Right.
And so Nixon gave the order. The order went out through his chief of staff. The order filtered down. A year and a half, the things are still there. And Nixon just hits the roof. Finally, through threats, he actually threatened to demote the admiral who had line authority for taking down the buildings, and threw a leaked story to the Washington Post, which makes it even perfect. They were actually torn down. And the day they were gone, Nixon called up his John Ehrlichman, his aide who had been responsible for this, and said, you know, finally we got something done. And it was just a matter of taking down 15 buildings from the National Mall. But he finally had a sense of authority because he got to do that.
Okay, so this is supposed to be reassuring for us.
As a conservative, it's very reassuring to me that the government can't do a lot of things.
Right. As Ronald Reagan used to say, be grateful you don't get all the government you pay for.
Right.
So one thing the president-elect will be able to do, as already seems to be doing, is change the relationship of the presidency with the media. Right? So 49 seats in the White House press room, almost all of them go to what we now call legacy institution newspapers, and whoever the next press secretary can be could say no, Washington Post out, Washington Free Beacon in, Drudge gets a seat.
Did you hear that laugh?
Press conferences, we won't have any more of those. The president of the United States, when he has a point to make, he'll tweet, and when he has a series of points to make, he will release a video to YouTube. This will be a new world. Correct or not?
Partly. Trump has a very complicated relationship with the press, and it was revealed after his election with his relationship with the New York Times. Remember, there was these negotiations over what conditions Trump would speak to the New York Times.
Yes.
Eventually, he went. He went to their building. He didn't bring the New York Times over to him in Trump Tower. He went to the New York Times building, which, when you think about someone like Donald Trump, always interested in hierarchies and poses and positions. He went there.
Big concession on his part.
Big concession. And he talked to them for an hour on the record. And at the end of it, he said, despite complaining about the press at the beginning of the talk, at the end of it, he said, I love the New York Times. You're the crown jewel of American papers. So it just reveals the complexity of Donald Trump. That is a man who, as much as he attacks the media and despises the media, also recognizes in one way his dependence on it, and then has a weird kind of stature in it. I think it goes back to being a New Yorker and coming from Queens, and a respect for the New York Times as an institution, even as he demeans it. What will that mean for him as president? When you talk about the populist right, since 1964, one of the main targets of the populist right has been the mainstream media. This has been a 50-year-long tradition. It's not going to stop. And in fact, in Trump, the right, the populist right, has a Tribune who is going to be extremely combative with the media, still is, and will remain so as president. But will all of those legacy institutions
be kicked out?
But
he'll also sell newspapers.
Right. Will all of those legacy institutions be kicked out? No. We might have a few of them. On the second point, you will have fewer press conferences because he doesn't want to be put on the spot. And he also believes in unpredictability. And so you're not going to have, the press is clamoring for one. He is not going to have these big press conferences where they ask him a million questions. He will control as much as he can how his image and in words are represented in the media.
One thing about that New York Times interview, which was absolutely fascinating document, he says it's the New York Times is the crown jewel of American papers, which it is. I mean, for all of its faults, it is an amazing product that comes out every day. On the other hand, he also says in that same interview, they ask him about Breitbart, which is the great bugbear of right thinkers nowadays. It's this disgusting alt-right, white nationalist. And he says, well, it's like the Times. It's a news organization like the Times. And I can imagine the cognitive dissonance in their brain when they go through the transcripts. Says, well, wait a minute, he called us the crown jewel, but then he said we're like Breitbart. So he clearly has a different conception of the press than anyone who's ever sat in the Oval Office. I would be surprised, actually, if he gave any press conferences. Why? You know, I would love to see the Free Beacon in the White House press office, but if you've ever gone to press briefings, one out of 10 are worthwhile.
Right.
And they're filled with peacocks posing for the cameras and all these reporters. Nothing ever happens. So why even have the White House press room? You know, why not have a place where they can all come if the press secretary has something to announce? Or you could just do it by tweeting. You know, I really think there's a possibility here that the establishment press is going to be disestablishment. What is it?
Defenestrated.
Disestablishmentarianism. Do you remember that word from English history about separating the church and the state?
Yes, yes.
I think there's a way that these people are going to be uncredentialed, and the people that we have come to think of as the mainstream media.
Last questions. Paul Krugman in the New York Times, quote, "So what do we do now? By we, I mean all of those left, center, and even right who saw Donald Trump as the worst man ever to run for president and assumed that a strong majority of our fellow citizens would agree," close quote. What do the liberals and the Democrats do now?
Well, if they follow what they've been doing since the election, it means they're going to run left. With some dissidents, like Tim Ryan, a congressman from Ohio who's challenged Nancy Pelosi in her speakership, in her minority leadership. Some Democrats saying they need to run left on economics, and others saying they need to run left on identity. That Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and it was only because she didn't make, I guess, a strong enough appeal to minority voters or to women voters that she was denied an electoral college victory in the White House. So they're of two minds, much like Donald Trump.
Yes, yes. If you call those minds. The important thing for them, I think, is it's exactly right to say that they are going to move to the left. But it really changes. Is it going to be Bernie Sanders, where they sort of become a more ostentatiously socialist party? Or is it going to be the left, where they take the political correctness, the identity politics, and really put the pedal to the metal and just go all out with that? You know, there is a tension between the two. I mean, Bernie Sanders, remember when he had a Black Lives Matter woman try and take over his rally, you know, was really quite forthright. And you started to think, well, this is not his brand of liberalism, this sort of exploiting different groups and cobbling them together. He's a populist who wants to, you know, give everybody tons of money. So.
Tons of our money. What do conservatives do now? Sit and wait for a while? Here, Peter Thiel, this is just before the election. I'm quoting Peter Thiel. "Trump's agenda is about making America a normal country. A normal country doesn't have a $500 billion trade deficit. A normal country doesn't fight five simultaneous wars. In a normal country, the government actually does its job," close quote. Is there anything in there to work with? Anything that connects in any way with the conservatism of William F. Buckley and Ronald Reagan?
Well, Buckley and Reagan didn't think we were a normal country. Yeah. And
I don't think most American presidents have ever thought
that
we're a normal country. I don't, and just, I think empirically, America is not a normal country. I mean, we're a continent-wide power spanning God knows how many ethnicities and languages and religions. We have this enumerated Bill of Individual Rights that is at the core of every American citizen. We're unusual. And so I didn't quite understand that Thiel speech. I thought the one he made at the convention was much more persuasive for Trump. And of course, in Trump's mind, America is a very special place now. Why? Because Donald Trump is going to be the president of
it. They like Donald Trump.
America will become exceptional very quickly. What do conservatives do? Wait and see. I think a lot of conservatives are having this debate of can they be a force for positive change or a good influence on the president if they were to enter government in whatever capacity. I personally believe they should. All people should try to work as much as they can. Others, I think, because of Trump's personality and because of the statements that he's made in the course of the campaign and also because of some of his supporters, will just never be in a position where they can endorse Trump as president.
So we're living with Richard Nixon again, where conservatives could support this or that aspect of what the president did, but they never could give him their hearts. And on this or that aspect of what he did, they had to oppose him.
Well, as we're sitting here today, you judge him by the appointments he's made. He's not Nixon. I mean, Nixon tried to make several statements with his early appointments that he was spanning the Rockefeller wing and the Goldwater wing of the party. Since the Rockefeller wing of the party doesn't exist anymore, Trump is clearly signaling something other than what Nixon.
So let me try the last question. Last exhortation, last admonition, last attempt to cheer up Matt. And here's the argument. If Hillary Clinton had won, and remember, only a matter of a few weeks ago, single digit number of weeks ago, we all assumed that she would. If Hillary Clinton had won, the Obama agenda, federal involvement in healthcare, high taxes, constant expansion of regulations, stagnant economy, would have been ratified and continued. The Supreme Court would have been given a liberal majority, which would have ruled for a generation, and the federal government would have remained hostile to and become more hostile to traditional notions of decency and religious belief, forcing the Little Sisters of the Poor to include contraceptives in their health care would have been just the beginning. And instead, boys, a miracle has happened. The Dow Jones is setting new records. Political correctness everywhere confused and on the defensive. Supreme Court, there's every reason to suppose he's going to appoint genuine originalists to the Supreme Court. Cabinet appointments, Betsy DeVos at education. Betsy DeVos is a tough, accomplished, pro-charter school activist. She's not going to coddle the teachers' unions. She's going to take them on. Tom Price, this congressman from Georgia at HHS, he spent 6 years studying how to undo Obamacare. So this guy has his flaws, but he really does want to make the country great again. And he seems by and large to be listening to the right people, and the early appointments are more than encouraging. So I put it to you boys that the quotation appropriate to the moment comes from the late, great Jean Kirkpatrick. We must learn to bear the truth about our country, no matter how good it might be. Andrew, have I persuaded you?
Yes, you left out the part about him being a maniac. See, all of that would be wonderful if it weren't for that little glitch in the whole thing.
Matthew?
I am like, I think, many conservatives, in that I am much happier with the election result than I thought I was going to be. And I am more cheerful for the country on precisely the reasons that you laid out than I had hoped I would. That said, two things. One, it's early. He hasn't even been inaugurated yet, and we're looking at a man who I think Steve Bannon, so at least 8 years, and Steve Bannon in a recent interview said they're going to rule for 50 years. And if, let me tell you, if Trump gets a second term, one of those amendments he's going to start changing is the term limit for president. I can guarantee that. The second point I make is this. I'm really, in the essay you quote, I'm really talking about the conservative intellectual movement. I'm not necessarily talking about the Republican Party or even the Republican conservative policy
analysts.
You're
talking about two dozen guys that we all know.
I know that, Peter, and I know them. And I say it's time for them to think anew as well, because what this showed was a real division within conservatism between the intellectuals and the populists, and also a division between the conservative movement and the broader forces of the country. And I think this is an opportunity for to think, well, what is actually happening in this country? And it's because we live in our bubbles. And the Washington, D.C. area where I live has done very well over the last 8 years. No wonder everybody thought Trump didn't have a chance. We didn't go out to the Rust Belt and see what life is like. And there, I think, it's a very different story.
So Donald Trump represents a healthy dose of reality, even for us conservatives. Andy?
You're talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Well, yes, in Matthew's sense, I agree with that completely. I think we're underestimating, though, conservatism in the Republican Party. They're not quite identical, but we really do have to understand that conservatives are a member of a party. They have a party, just as liberals do. And I think the conservative intellectuals failed by not taking that as seriously as they should have.
Matthew Continetti, Andrew Ferguson, thank you. For the Hoover Institution and Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.